Good morning, everybody. I want to start by having everyone pull out a piece of paper. And I want you to think about, just over the last few days, an experience that you had or something that you observed in which it highlighted something about this course, something related to the concepts in this course, related to diversity, discrimination, stereotypes. So anything related to this course that you experienced over the past couple of days, just write down that situation, whether it's something that you observed, something that you felt, something that you did that relates to the concepts in this course. So everyone's writing down one example of something that happened in the past couple of days that relates to this course. So either something that you did, something that you observed, something that you experienced, something that you felt that relates to this course. Okay, now I want you to pair up and share with the person next. Pair up with someone and share about the experience. Okay, what are some of the things that you experienced that highlights some of the concepts in this course? Things that stood out just on campus, in the community, back at home. Something that you experienced that sort of highlights a particular concept in this course. Yeah.
I was in class the other day and we were asked to game groups, and all of the international students kind of stuck with each other.
Interesting. That's a great example. I mean, I was reading over your analytic memos, and some of the questions that came up, a reoccurring question was, how do you counteract discrimination or bias or prejudice? And it's very hard because we just naturally congregate towards people who are familiar and similar to us, whether you're part of the minority or less dominant group, or you're part of the majority or dominant group. You tend to gravitate towards people who are similar and familiar and safe. So that's a great example. Did you have one?
I noticed the difference between individuality and diversity.
Uh-huh.
That was a problem that I had. It was like kind of combining the two.
Yeah.
But I noticed the diversity of people on the basketball courts at the SRSC, the different genders
uh-huh.
and sizes and races.
Interesting.
And all sorts of different things.
Yeah, yeah. So in many ways you can, if you want, you can put on your diversity glasses and walk into a setting and it really changes the way you view a situation or an organization. Very good. That's one thing that we're going to be covering a lot in this class is there are clear laws in place that restrict people from discriminating against people within particular social categories, but it's extremely difficult to enforce those laws. It's very hard if you're a victim or being violated based on one of these civil rights laws. You might have a very clear case, but to prove it, to prove that you are discriminated against because you're pregnant or because you're a woman or because you're of a certain ethnicity or sexual orientation, it's very difficult. And also, you're already at a position of disadvantage because you tend to be of the less dominant group or a minority group, and so then you're going up against the majority structures, and to actually build up a case is really difficult. I mean, there's been some huge cases that have been won, but it's a very uphill battle, and so then it's a challenge knowing what the laws are and then what the social laws end up being implemented in practice are sometimes two different things. Other examples. Trent.
Walking around campus, they've kind of been there since the first day of classes, but all the different groups, like on the sidewalks and chalk,
uh-huh.
you can just see all the different groups, like call-out meetings and things for like religious groups and
uh-huh.
athletic and academic groups. It's just
yeah.
dozens of different types of groups.
Yeah, there's a lot of variety, a lot of options available. Interestingly, I saw something in the news over the weekend that related to this course, and I'm going to show you the quick video clip. Probably you guys have heard like Google and Facebook and a lot of the high-tech companies have done what's called diversity audits, where they've looked at the social composition of their workforce and have concluded we're not very diverse, and then how do we change that? And so just this weekend, Twitter came out on Friday and basically said, we've done a diversity audit, but now we're going to set these diversity goals. And it made big news on Friday. It's one of the first major high-tech companies that's established clear-cut goals that they actually want to accomplish within the next year. And when you set a goal and you make it public, you're all of a sudden accountable to whether or not you're going to meet that goal. And so we're just going to look at a quick clip of Twitter and its diversity goals.
Last year, Twitter joined the tech company trend by publishing its diversity numbers. That's how the company breaks down by different backgrounds and cultures of its employees. Last July, 70% of Twitter employees were men, and 72% of Twitter managers were white. That wasn't good enough for the company, apparently, because the company has posted today it's committed to making its U.S. workforce more diverse by the end of next year, that's 2016, specifically by increasing the number of female employees to 35%, women in tech roles to 16%, that's up from 10, and women in leadership roles to 25%, up from 21. Twitter also has a goal of raising its minority employee numbers to 11% overall. That would be up from 7% last year, 9% in tech roles, and 6% in leadership roles. The company says that the changes should reflect the vast range of people who use Twitter.
So the last thing that she said was Twitter's goal for wanting to become more diverse is to reflect the vast array of users on Twitter. So they want their leadership and their workforce to reflect their consumer base, the customers and their constituents, which to me makes a lot of sense. If you're an organization, you have a clientele or a constituency, you will be more effective as an organization if you have people on the inside, and especially leaders, who understand the different constituencies that you're attempting to serve. And it's kind of significant that like Twitter and Google and Facebook are doing this and doing this in a very public fashion, because it trickles down into other organizations when they begin to think about, well, what about us? You know, if Twitter sees this as a value and Twitter sees this as important, then maybe it's something that we should adopt and embrace as well. But I still think it's an open question of whether or not diversity adds value to an organization. And so what I want to do is just sort of create two lists. One is the benefits of being diverse, all the potential benefits of being diverse, and then this side will be all of the potential drawbacks associated with having a diverse organization. So if I want you to think about yourself as a leader within an organization and you're making a pitch to the board of directors and saying, we need to become more diverse. And it doesn't really necessarily matter in this context what the organization is, but I want you to just throw out examples of the values or potential benefits of being diverse.
So like a wider range of ideas.
Okay. Variety of ideas. Good. Ashley?
Different perspectives.
Mercedes?
It might help you reach a broader clientele.
Okay. Broader audience.
You help draw on different demographics.
Different demographics.
Might send a message of like being inclusive rather than exclusive.
Yeah. So being inclusive.
Like more like networks or connections with like other cultures.
Okay. So networks.
I guess it could better help you represent the population.
Okay. So representativeness.
Benefits communication.
Communication? In what way, like?
You could be bilingual.
Okay. Linguistic diversity. Okay, so this is a good working list of the benefits. One of the challenges is if you're an organization, oftentimes think about the bottom line. Like the bottom line is your return on investment, the capital gains for your organization. And sometimes you could look at these things and say, well, would this necessarily translate into a greater return on investments? These are admirable things to aspire to, but they might not necessarily, there's a lot of cost involved in making your organization diverse, and it might not translate into an increase in return on investments. There are other bottom lines. There's social profit of an organization. So oftentimes you'll hear people talking about the triple bottom line, which is profits, people, and the environment. You have triple bottom lines, multiple bottom lines that you might be aspiring to as an organization. But a lot of times when you think about diversity, you also have to be clear on, well, what are our ultimate bottom lines that we're aspiring to? And if you think about some of the disadvantages or drawbacks, what are some that come to mind?
Communication problems.
Communication? Okay, in what sense, like?
Different languages.
Okay. So communication challenges. Olivia.
Racial tension.
Racial tension. Trent.
I was going to say religious tension.
Uh-huh. You.
Conflict as to how, like, work should be done.
Okay. So, conflict with approaches.
If you're making the move from a non-diverse organization to a more diverse, then you might have to lose some decent workers that are part of the majority.
Okay. So, reverse discrimination?
Olivia.
Okay, greater misunderstandings. Okay, so what I think is important to realize, let's say like an organization like Twitter, it's not random that they're very homogeneous. It wasn't just sort of all of a sudden they woke up and they looked and like, wow, 72% of our workforce is male, 70% was white. That wasn't just sort of random. Like, it wasn't just they, you know, they had all these applications and they just started selecting people randomly without consideration of gender or race or other categories. There's things involved in the hiring process that are oftentimes unconscious, but they lead you to forming an organization that tends to be very homogeneous. And so my question would be, and this would be more of like a policy related question, is that should creating a diverse organization be mandatory or voluntary? So it sort of skirts around the issue of like affirmative action, but in a broader scope. Like, should there be some sort of national policy or state level policy, whether it be the public sector or the private sector, that becoming a more diverse organization is something that should be mandatory, or is it something that should be voluntary? And so I'm going to split the class up into four groups, and I'm going to assign a perspective. So some of you are going to be a group that says, is going to be advocating that making a diverse organization should be mandatory, and the other groups are going to say, no, it should be something that's purely voluntary and it shouldn't be mandated. So these five people, you guys are going to be mandate. You're going to mandate that organizations become more diverse. You're going to have to come up together, you're going to work together and sort of come up with a case to persuade the rest of the class that you think it should be mandated. So even if you don't think it should be mandated right now, you have to pretend like you're 100% convinced that it should be mandated. Then the next group, these two rows, this eight, you're going to be advocating saying that it's voluntary and it should be voluntary and it shouldn't be mandated. And then, let's see, these six are going to be mandated, and then you two and those four are going to be voluntary. So we're going to have two rounds of debates, and basically you guys are going to have 3 minutes or so to come up with your talking points, and you got to come up with a scribe and then a spokesperson for your group. So does that make sense? Mandated, voluntary, mandated, voluntary. So you guys have to go back there. Okay, go. Okay, are you guys, do you need more time or are you ready? You're ready? Okay. Make sure you know who's going to be representing you, be your spokesperson. And we're going to start with this group, and it looks like Sam has been declared the spokesperson. You got to stand up and make your case.
Okay. So, becoming diversity mandatory because I feel like the companies that serve a community should represent the community. Everybody in the company should have something they can relate to. It's like the comfort level of working inside the company. It also like harbors good communication, learning everybody's different communication styles and stuff like that. It also offers a wide variety of like ideas and perspectives, and so that's why diversity should be mandatory, because it just benefits the company so much.
Cool. Now this group here, that they would say that no, it should be purely voluntary and not mandated.
Yes,
Nick.
It should be voluntary. Reasons are threefold. We have it opens up the door for reverse discrimination against a majority of people who would have to get out of the way to make room for a more diverse workforce. We also believe that it takes away the business's rights and it hurts the free market, because you have to, if you have quotas and things like that, you are not truly a free market, I would say. And then also, we believe that it should be voluntary, but incentivized instead of forced mandatory.
Incentivized? In what way? Like?
So if you are more diverse, you get tax credits.
Credits, okay. That's a good potential happy medium. That's good. And then the mandators.
So we basically built off the platforms saying that the world is already a diverse setting to begin with. So implementing diversity is a pro. It brings a wider range of qualifications to your workforce. It also gives a better sense of understanding and interpretation to your workforce. You could also outsource better and more efficiently if you have diversity. And then diversity also leads to expansion, which ties into outsourcing. By having diversity, you have a better source of communication. And we gave a couple examples of two of the larger companies in the world, Kraft and Google. Google just hired the new CEO as a Indian-born person. I forgot what his name was, but we discussed the matter.
Mm-hmm.
And then Irene Rosenfeld, who's probably the most powerful CEO in the world of Kraft, is a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she had worked in that workforce for about 25 years. I actually met her. And she spoke just about diversity and how that helped Kraft themselves expand and become a powerhouse.
That's great. Good. And then the voluntary people in the back.
So our main focus was that we want to have a strong workforce. So we said if it's mandatory that we might be forced to bring in less qualified employers. Also, bringing in diverse employees may hurt the company's culture and negatively affect the customers and services that we provide. The freedom to create a workplace where individuals are more similar and have the same set of values will also make job tasks run smoother because there'll be less complications and miscommunications, so our productivity will go up. Enforcing a mandatory law would make room for certain companies to always take advantage or cheat the system anyways. We have the freedom to bring on individuals that we see fit for the position without any discrimination involved.
So it's interesting, I put this in the context of an organization, but you could also apply it to yourself personally. You know, should you have a personal mandate to seek out diversity in diverse organizations, or should you just sort of go with what the outcomes are? And I think a lot of times, a question that was often asked was, how do we overcome discrimination, or how do we overcome this tendency of homophily, of sort of congregating towards people who are similar to us? I would argue that it starts with sort of looking at sort of your own personal decisions of the types of groups that you're involved with or that you're participating in, and are those groups on the end of being more homogeneous in along different dimensions, or are they more diverse? And it's a challenge because we make decisions of which groups of people we're going to hang out with and associate with, whether it be when you decide what neighborhood you're going to move into, or when you think about if you have children, what schools are they going to go to, or what social groups you're going to be a part of. If you just sort of do an audit of your own social groupings, you can see, do my groups tend to skew towards the side of being more homogeneous or being more diverse? And if I want to sort of actively counteract this tendency to congregate towards like-minded people, should I put a personal mandate to sort of say, hey, I'm gonna make it a point to get involved in groups where people are not like me? And I would say that there's value in that. There's effort and cost in doing that. I mean, you'll be socially awkward, you won't feel like you fit in, but on the back end, the benefits and the experiences that you get from sort of immersing yourself in a community that's different from you would really create benefits in the long run. But it's so we can talk about organizations being mandated to do this. That would be much more complicated to pull off policy-wise, but on an individual level, you can sort of make a personal mandate of, hey, I say that I value diversity. My life doesn't necessarily reflect diversity, and so possibly I could make a personal mandate to sort of pursue diversity on some level. And in the chapter that we read, it talked about minority groups, and a lot of you sort of pointed this out. Minority groups, whatever the category is, is actually a misnomer. It's not about the proportions of people determine minority groups, but they made a distinction between the dominant group and the non-dominant group. And oftentimes, not oftentimes, but at different times, the group could be a majority in population, but still be the non-dominant group. And so what we're really talking about here is not proportions of people, but who has the power, who has the claim on the resources, who has the capacity to make decisions. A lot of times, the way this plays out is, it isn't just sort of who are the larger numbers and they're in control, but it's more so the people who are in control put in systems and structures to maintain their power and their control. And one of the most striking examples of this was in South Africa under apartheid. Less than 10% of the population in South Africa during the height of apartheid, less than 10% were white. So that meant that less than 10% of the population controlled what went on in that entire society. And so they were a clear minority, proportion-wise, but the white population was the dominant force within that community. And there's a clip that just sort of highlights what the dynamics in South Africa were under apartheid to sort of illustrate this distinction between, it's not just minority representation, but it's more what group is it, the dominant group that's in power.
Nelson Mandela became South Africa's first democratically elected president in 1994. It was the official end of white minority rule, otherwise known as apartheid. Apartheid, you've heard of it, but what exactly was it? I'm Francesca Fiorentini, and this is AJ Plus. Apartheid is an Afrikaans word that means separateness. It was a system of racial segregation that governed South Africa for nearly 50 years. It specifically aimed to protect the domination of the white South Africans over non-whites in every aspect of life. But it didn't just appear out of thin air. During the colonial grab for the country between the Dutch-descended Afrikaners and the British, the rights of native black South Africans were sidelined. So when apartheid was officially made law in 1948 by the Afrikaner-led National Party, it was a continuation of injustices already happening. Afrikaners believed that South Africa was their God-given homeland, and that the white race was superior. The black majority was therefore seen as a threat. There were 148 apartheid laws. Blacks had to carry ID permits at all times and had to obey strict curfews. Public facilities were separated for white and non-white use, and marriages between whites and other races were banned. People were classified into four racial categories: white, black, Indian, and colored, people of mixed race. And they were all separated into different residential areas. Blacks were divided into 10 so-called homelands based on tribal groups. Homelands were rural, overcrowded, and lacked jobs, forcing blacks to seek work as migrant laborers. Wages were low, and it was illegal for workers to strike. See, apartheid was also economically motivated. A cheap workforce was needed, particularly to work in the country's gold mines. Powerful mining magnates had a huge stake in apartheid policies, since their profits depended on keeping black wages low. Outside their designated homelands, non-whites had no political rights. Since they were not technically citizens, they couldn't vote. Education? Also divided. The state set up a separate education system for blacks that received a fraction of the funding that white schools did. Mandatory education ended at age 13 and was structured to funnel blacks into menial migrant labor. Exploitation? By design. Needless to say, there was resistance to these insane laws. Protests were often led by black students and youth and were met with severe repression. Out of these struggles came leaders like Nelson Mandela, Oliver Tambo, and Walter Sisulu, who would help bring an eventual end to apartheid. So now that you know what apartheid was, could you imagine living under it? Are there any similarly unjust laws that still exist where you live? Leave us your comments below. Peace and reconciliation.
When I watch a video like that or hear a report of during the civil rights era in the U.S., it's hard to conceptualize what it would be like to either be a white person in that society, and I'd be like, I would never do that, or to experience as a minority or the non-dominant group in that setting where, you know, I would say, I would never put up with that. But it's amazing how the system becomes so normal. and it's just accepted. I think there's a thing in the textbook that talked about internalized racism, where you have the non-dominant group or the minority group who internalizes sort of the norms of the surrounding society, and it's just sort of, that's the way it is, and don't rock the boat, and sort of just go along to get along. And we would say, well, gosh, that was in South Africa under the apartheid regime, or that was in the U.S. during the civil rights era. But I would argue that we become more sophisticated in how we incorporate these dominant, non-dominant systems and structures. So it isn't maybe as blatant as signs that say, you know, colored and white people, different bathrooms or different drinking fountains, but we're just more nuanced and sophisticated in how we incorporate these systems and structures that help one group to succeed and make it much more challenging for the other group. And so some of the things that it talked about in the book and that we talked about even the last class was characteristics of the non-dominant group. One is the identifiability. And it was interesting in South Africa, you know, is maybe uncertain, well, are you white or non-white? And so you had ID cards that if you got pulled over, if you got stopped by an official, you had to display your ID card so that it was very clear what category you are a part of. And so even if it's ambiguous as far as what your identity is, these systems will put in place where you have an ID card. You know, and it's interesting, my kids are in elementary school, and they have this food voucher system where free and reduced lunch, where like if your kid is part of a household that is of lower income, then you get a reduced lunch at school. But what's interesting is you have a card that you have to display to get that reduced lunch or free lunch. And so, you know, we would say, oh, we'd never make non-dominant groups be identified or standing out. But think about it, an elementary school kid has a card where they have to show that every time they're walking through the lunch line. All their friends, you know, in front of them or behind them would see that. And it's a way of sort of signaling or making known status differences. And so schools are actually cognizant of this, and they're thinking of ways of how do you provide for people who might be lower income or low SES, but not necessarily single them out through identification cards in a way. And so, you know, and these aren't conscious things that we do, but they're systems that are in place that sort of reinforce differences. And not just linear differences like separation, but hierarchical differences of status. And so, and that affects the social relations. And then another characteristic of the non-dominant groups is differential power. And I find this very fascinating. If you go into settings where you have a non-dominant group that's running a program, and someone from the dominant culture walks into that room, there's this natural deference to the dominant figure. And so I have a friend who works, he's Caucasian, and he works in a predominantly African-American church, and he's basically a volunteer within this church. But one of the things that he has sort of fought against and sort of resisted is the tendency of the people in this church to want him to be put up in front and to be a spokesperson and to be a representative. And he's like, this is very strange. Here I am, a white person in a black church, and they want me, in a sense, to be the leader, to be the spokesperson, to give the presentations. And for him, he what he observes is this natural deference to the dominant group. And it would be the same in situations where if it was a male walks into the group, whether the male would sort of assume the position of leadership, or oftentimes people would just defer to the male to be the person in power or in control. Now, these aren't always the case, but they are patterns of deference. Deference to the more dominant group. And so even if you have a group that's a majority of the people are non-dominant, if there's a small proportion of dominant people in the room or in the organization, they will sort of rise to sort of be in positions of power and control. And so again, there's these unconscious patterns of relating that have been built up over time, and it's just sort of, well, that's just the normal thing, or that's just sort of, that person seems like to fit in that position of authority or leadership. And so the differential power, even if you're a majority group, you still defer to what socially would be construed as the dominant group. And there are there's these social hierarchies, whether, you know, we talk a lot about race and gender, but obviously class. The higher SES person will sort of naturally sort of assume the position of leadership or control. It could be because the way they're dressed. Higher SES people are dressed more professionally. It could be just their vocabulary. They're more articulate, and so they can naturally step into these positions. Or if you think of U.S.-born versus immigrant, the U.S.-born person has higher social status, and so they're going to take on positions of leadership more easily than maybe someone who's immigrant or English as a second language. And so this isn't necessarily, I don't want to paint this as good or bad. I want to paint it as a social reality. And in light of that reality, how do we feel about that? How is that for the different social groups? And what would be a healthy or an appropriate response to these things? So it's not, oh, this is really bad or good, or but it's more, this is reality. These are social realities. These are social facts. And then how do we respond to that if we're leading an organization? And how do we even sort of counteract that? If we sort of say, yeah, this, there's some things about that that's kind of messed up, or there's things about that that sort of put our organization at a disadvantage, and I want to actively counteract that. And so a part of it is just simply being cognizant of it and being aware of it. And we talked about discrimination, another characteristic of non-dominant groups. They tend to be discriminated against. And there's different forms of discrimination. And so one would be access discrimination. You know, I find this fascinating. Again, being a white person, I can go anywhere at any time with no questions asked about why I'm there. Dressed like this, I can walk anywhere on campus, I can walk anywhere in the community, and no one will bat an eye. No one will ask me for an ID, no one will ask me why I'm there. I have 100% access. If I was of a different class, of a different race, it'd be a totally different story. There'd be access differentials. People would question, why are you here? Or if it's at different times of the day or different parts of the community, I will be asked. And so not only is there just sort of public access discrimination, but then it gets the bar gets even raised higher when you're talking about employment. Again, there's access discrimination to just simply getting your foot in the door to get a job. There's also treatment discrimination. And so there's different ways that different people within an organization are treated based on their social category. And I think, I don't know if it's a question here or not, but there was, why is it that women would be more discriminated against than men in the hiring process? And, you know, as I thought about that, like, yeah, at face value, it's like, well, gosh, if you have two equal candidates, why would the job go to the man versus the woman? And I want you guys to think about when you were growing up and you were sick and you couldn't go to school. If your dad stayed home with you when you couldn't go to school, I want you to raise your hand. Okay? Now, if your mom is the one who stayed home with you, I want you to raise your hand. So if I, okay, you can put your hands down. So if I'm a potential employer and I want to get the most out of my employee and I have a male applicant and a female applicant who's married, both of them are married, let's say, because that was another question. You say, why does it matter if they're married and have a family or not? Like, that should have no effect on their performance. But if I'm an employer and I'm sitting here thinking, okay, here's a woman with children and here's a man with children, and I know, just observed here, that if the kid is sick, none of you raised your hand saying that your dad stayed home with you, and almost all of you raised your hand saying that your mom stayed home with you. And it's even more complicated if you're a single parent, because then there aren't any other options. Or if you're of a lower class and you don't have a babysitter or a nanny that you can hire. And so, is that bad that the employer would discriminate and sort of select the married male person with kids versus the married female person with kids? Is that discrimination, or is that just a wise business choice? And that's a question. I mean, it, technically, as someone said, that it is illegal to discriminate based on gender. Does it happen? Is it even sort of done just sort of oftentimes unconsciously? Like, probably none of you had sat and thought, like, you know, based on the questions that you asked me, you're like, well, why does it matter if it's a male or female, and why does it matter if they're married or not married? But I think it's evident what might go through the mind of an employer as they're thinking about who they want to hire. And so there's discrimination of access and treatment, and there's also secondary discrimination, which I find very fascinating. So think of a population that's being discriminated against. They, in turn, discriminate people within their group. So there's a research on, it was African Americans with HIV/AIDS, and it was this long ethnography of just sort of talking to African American homosexuals. And they frequently referred to this idea of double discrimination. So not only are they discriminated in broader society because of their race, but then even within the African American community, because of their sexuality or sexual orientation, they received discrimination within the Black community. So they were like double ostracized. And so there's discrimination is a social reality that groups do, even if you're the discriminated against and you know what it feels like to be discriminated, we are very quick to turn and then discriminate against someone else. And then the last form of discrimination is reverse discrimination. And this is an interesting one. This is sort of the card that I would say white males will often play. And they'll say, well, what about reverse discrimination? Like, that's not fair. You know, we can exist for a very, very long time and be silent about the fact that discrimination is happening all around. But the moment that it is perceived as possibly being reverse discrimination, I'm quick to throw up the card and say, hey, foul! Discrimination just happened. This is not fair. And yet, 99% of my life experience, discrimination has happened, but I've been the beneficiary of it. And so I'm always suspicious of myself and of others if I raise the reverse discrimination card, and yet I don't highlight discrimination when it's happening in other contexts, when there's access discrimination or treatment discrimination. And so for me, that's just sort of a self-exercise of, like, if I'm feeling like, hey, you know, I think reverse discrimination is happening, or I think I'm being hindered because of reverse discrimination, I need to ask myself, are there other forms or situations where discrimination has occurred and I've actually been the beneficiary of it? I know, like, when I was looking for a job, I was like, well, goodness, I'm in this job market, I'm at a disadvantage because I'm a white male. I'm a white male who teaches on the importance of diversity within organizations. My research would say, don't hire me. But when I think about it and step back, I realize how much I have benefited tremendously because of my social status. And so if there is sort of a swing towards creating opportunities that are more equally distributed, then for me, that seems like a fair system, that I have benefited greatly from a system that sort of benefits and promotes the dominant group of white males, that if there is opportunities to create a more equitable environment, I think that that's a fair thing, and I'm not as resistant to it. But more so, I need to sort of be cautious of the times where I say reverse discrimination is happening and yet never point it out when it's happening and it's to my advantage. The fourth characteristics of the dominant, non-dominant groups is group awareness. And this is what I'd say maybe the only positive aspect of the dominant, non-dominant, is that when you are the group that's being marginalized or discriminated against, your identity or an affiliation with that group becomes much more salient. Like, you become much more aware of the fact that you are the non-dominant group, or that you're the minority group within a particular setting. When you're the majority group and you're the dominant, it's sort of normal. The way that life operates, the way that decisions are made, the way that people interact, is just viewed as normal. It doesn't sort of seem strange or unusual or unfair in any way, but when you're the non-dominant group and the minority within a particular setting, you feel it. You feel it, you experience it, and you then begin to create a form of solidarity with people who are maybe going through the same experience. And so I think when Nick mentioned that the international students congregated, there's a reason for that, because they're all feeling the challenges potentially of English being their second language, of not understanding fully the customs and traditions and cultures of Hoosier land. And so out of a sense of safety or self-protection, you congregate towards people who are similar to you, especially when you're the minority. And ultimately, what you have an opportunity to do is push back against the system and saying, we are being treated unfairly. We are being treated in ways that are not equitable or fair to that are the way that other groups are being treated. And so there's this sense of group awareness and coming together and mobilizing. And I think someone had written in one of the reflections that, what about this idea of strength in numbers? You know, can't the majority, if you can sort of, the group that's non-dominant sort of grows in numbers, can't they get strength in numbers? And I would say yes. If the people are organized, then they have opportunities to make change to systems. And again, if you're managing an organization where you have a subpopulation that is disgruntled and they're organizing, I would say it'd probably be best for you to understand what their grievances are and sort of address them and engage them rather than trying to suppress them, because as they organize and build power, there could be a revolt or it could be a sense where the group just sort of splinters up and becomes highly ineffective. So those are some of the characteristics of non-dominant groups. The thing that I want to talk about more explicitly is this idea of bias, that where bias in the hiring process, bias in sort of the social circles that we hang out with, and the sort of the root of biases is stereotypes. And I want to hear from you all whether or not stereotypes are true. How many would say, by raise of hands, that stereotypes are true? Okay, and how many would say that stereotypes are false? Okay, I want the people who think that stereotypes are false to sort of share why you think they're false.
I think that, like, sometimes people can fit the stereotypes, but I also think there are so many examples of people not fitting the stereotypes, like, it cannot be applied to all people. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like, there might be a few examples of people fitting the stereotype, but, like, there are so many examples of people not fitting the stereotype that,
such that they're not always true.
Yeah.
What about in the back?
I think, like, oftentimes when, like, a majority race sees, like, another race, for example, they just, like, discriminate, whether it's, like, unconsciously or consciously, whether or not they do something in a certain way, or they just place, like, a certain stereotype on that group of people without even going up to them and, like, asking them, like, who they are and, like, what they're all about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, okay, the people who say stereotypes are true, give me an explanation for why they're true. Tucker.
I would say there is a basis somewhere. I mean, it doesn't just come out of left field.
Uh-huh.
I don't think there is black or white or absolute when it comes to, like, stereotyping somebody, but there is generally a basis for why it's there.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm, like, the same with that. Like, it comes from somewhere. But I just feel like every stereotype is just exaggerated completely.
Uh-huh.
So.
Okay, exaggerated. Jeff?
I think, like, they're always true, but sometimes they are because like, stereotypes have been around for so long that it's just kind of been, like, conditionalized into other people, especially, like, Asians or black people. Just, if, like, if I'm supposed to be good at math, then, like, I'm going to, like, study math then.
Uh-huh.
Be good at it.
So to what extent are they true? Or should we abolish stereotypes, or are they helpful? What should be our response to this idea of stereotyping people? Nick?
I think that stereotypes do happen a lot, but I think that your approach should always be going into a situation is to assume that this person doesn't fit the stereotype before, and then get to know them more and more before you group them into something. So I feel like sometimes people just see a group of people and just immediately judge them and stereotype them from the get-go without knowing any other information about them other than what they look like.
Mm-hmm.
So before you stereotype, maybe actually get some information from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other thoughts? Did you have one?
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to, like, continue on from what he was saying by saying that, like, stereotypes, I feel like they're more of, like, a safety mechanism. Like, you just, like, see a group of people and you're like, oh, okay, they have different interests from me. They may have the same interests as me, but they just look like they don't. So I'm going to go ahead and, like, associate myself with this group of people instead.
Uh-huh.
But to counteract that, you should just, like, go in with an open mind and just, like, talk to the group of people that you're not familiar with and just see if you actually are the same as them.
Uh-huh.
Because, like, oftentimes you can find something that you can relate to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, so, I mean, my understanding of the reason why we stereotype is because sort of what Nick proposed takes a lot of effort, you know, to walk into a setting and say, okay, I'm going to have a blank slate for everybody. That's going to take a lot of energy to figure out who everyone is. And so the reason why we stereotype is it's a very efficient system. We can just, like, quickly assess a room and categorize people and figure out who we want to be friends with, who's going to be someone who would be a leader in the group, who is someone who really isn't going to add much value to the group, and we just do a quick, very efficient mode of categorizing people. Like, because we don't have time to, I mean, there's 28 people in this class, we don't have time to sort of sit down and sort of say, okay, I have a blank slate, and I just want to know everything about you so that I don't come in with these preconceived ideas of what you're like. That's just very difficult. And so there's this, the reason why we use stereotyping is just that it's an efficient way to put people into categories. And that's sort of this idea of social categorization. We don't like unknowns. We don't like ambiguity. We want to sort of have people be in their places. And even when someone doesn't fit the stereotype, that doesn't shatter the stereotype. It's just like, wow, here's an anomaly. Okay, let's go back to my stereotype. Here's how my assumptions of how this person would operate and work and interact. So it's an efficient system, but there's some drawbacks to it. And there's some major deficits to just sort of operating fully in this stereotyping mechanism. I have one more video about stereotypes, just to show the drawbacks of stereotyping.
We live in a world of an estimated 6.8 billion people. That's a lot of people. And yet every single one of us is unique and different in our own way, whether it's down to size, race, sexual orientation, religion, age, or even personality traits. From the moment we are born, we are placed in boxes, or categories, to save ourselves the trouble of getting to know people personally. This is where stereotypes come from, and where prejudice becomes a problem. From the guy who hangs out with girls, so it must mean that he's gay, or to the Muslim people, that as soon as we see them coming down the street, we assume they must all be terrorists. So why do we do this? And what makes us view people in this way? It comes from many sources, be it the media, who feeds us crap 24 hours a day about image, and the horror stories about gay rights, druggies, chavs, paedophiles, which affects our judgment on innocent people. From our parents, such as your mum telling you not to hang out with those kids because they look weird, or your friends laughing at the local overweight person in the street. Most of all, it's down to us, yes you, how we view the world and the people in it. So okay, everyone is different, and we may not share the same ideas, beliefs, interests, preferences, or life experience, but that doesn't give us the right to belittle them and make prejudgments on people we don't know. Stand Against Stereotypes is a simple campaign. We believe that everyone should be treated equally and that no one should be above or below anyone else. If we improve the relationships of the people around us, then maybe we can all begin to respect one another. We are all different for a reason. And that is what is so beautiful about the world that we live in. Stand against stereotypes.
I think for me, a lot of my hope with this class is on an individual level, helping people to become more cognizant of our practices and our ways of behaving and being cognizant of it, because I think that's a large part. The kind of the eerie part of all of this is that it's all done unconsciously, or a lot of it is done unconsciously. Like we go into autopilot mode of interacting with people. And so stereotypes, there are these overgeneralizations. There's truth to them. They're grounded in something, but they're overgeneralized and they're just blindly mapped onto people into different categories. And what it leads to is this idea of prejudice. So you have stereotyping, which is the base of it, and then you have prejudice, which is a prejudgment. It's an attitude about a person. And so stereotyping is a generalization, and then what comes out of that is prejudice. Like we prejudge, like we sort of already anticipate what this person is going to do or think or be. And so, and that's where prejudice sort of affects the decisions that we make, because we've already made a judgment on the person with data that isn't even necessarily coming from that person. It's based on these generalizations that we have. And so you have prejudice, which is an attitude, and then discrimination is the behavior. So you have stereotyping, which is generalizations, prejudice, which is sort of in our mind an attitude or a prejudgment, an anticipation of what the outcome is going to be, and then discrimination is my action or behavior based on that. And that's then where it becomes demonstrable that you're making decisions or performing actions that discriminate against one group over another. But it's rooted in sort of these stereotypes and these prejudgments that we have. And so those three words aren't synonyms, but they're part of this social process that occurs. Like society maps on these broad stroke generalizations that we just sort of blindly adopt and say, okay, these are true and this is an efficient way to categorize people. And then when we're in social settings, we need to make quick judgments. And so we have these prejudices that sort of drive our judgments about people. And then we need to make a decision and make an action or a behavior, and that's where then discrimination takes place. And so a part of the process is just sort of walking into a situation saying, okay, what are the stereotypes, what are the assumptions that I have when I'm walking into this situation? And, you know, knowing sort of the salience or the strength of these stereotypes and knowing that they're not necessarily always true, but knowing that they also affect my judgments of people. And so then the last one that I want to talk about is the fundamental attribution error. How many of you remember reading that or coming across it? The fundamental attribution error. The reason why I wish it was a better word or phrase to describe it is because it's a very true thing. So if I'm a white person and I get into Harvard University, my posture, my thought, or my interpretation of this experience is I earned it. I worked my butt off in high school, and I got in. You know, there's this idea of personal achievement, I worked hard, a meritocracy of like, I earned it and I got in as a white person. So I show up at Harvard, and I turn to my right, and I see an African-American male. I know how he got in, because of his race. It's clear it wasn't necessarily personal achievement, but it's because of affirmative action or something external to that person. So the fundamental attribution error is if you're the dominant group or the in-group, it's achievement, like my internal characteristics, the things that I have done to earn that. And then if it's someone in the out-group who gets in, it's because of something external to them. Well, it's not because of their personal achievement, but it's because of some external factor like a hiring policy or admission policy. Now then, say I go on to the graduate and I go into the marketplace and I apply for a job, and as a white person, I didn't get the job. Well, it's not because I wasn't qualified. I mean, clearly, I was extremely qualified. I mean, I've worked my butt off all through college. The reason I didn't get the job is nothing because of internal to me, but it's because of these external factors of, let's say, affirmative action or things that are out of my control. That's the reason why I didn't get the job. And then the same minority, who's the African-American male, doesn't get the job. It's because he was underqualified. I mean, he just didn't really have what it takes to get the job. It's something intrinsic or internal to that person. That's the explanation for not getting the job. So this fundamental attribution error is this sort of social psychological process of how do we explain social outcomes. And if I get something good, it's because of my personal achievement. And if someone who's of the minority group gets something good, well, it's because of external factors. And then if something bad happens to me as the white person, it's because of some external factors. Whereas if something bad happens to a minority person, it's because of something internal. And this isn't just with getting into college or getting a job, but it's walking through your neighborhood. It's related to the criminal justice system. A white person gets arrested, it's like, whoa, 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 you know, I was framed, or there's this, you know, external explanation, but then if I look to someone who's a minority, it's like, oh yeah, they probably did it. You know, they deserve to get caught. And so this idea of fundamental attribution error, it's another one of these social realities. We just do it without even thinking about it. It's just sort of our internal processing of, like, when an outcome occurs, we need some way to explain it. And so you can either explain it by internal characteristics of personal achievement or accomplishment or qualification, or you can explain it through external factors. And so in society, if you're part of the in-group, positive outcomes are based on internal characteristics. Negative outcomes are based on external factors. And so this influences sort of how we relate to people and how we even look at maybe someone's resume in the hiring process of, like, deciding, you know, what are the qualifications of the person. And so this idea of fundamental attribution error, again, is one of these very subtle subconscious things that we do almost instantaneous calculations of, but we do it. And if you are able to sort of step back and sort of look at your own personal explanations for outcomes in your life or in the lives of people around you, you will begin to see, oh yeah, I kind of do that too. I mean, it's not a good thing or bad thing, it's just a social reality. It's how we relate to people, it's how we explain situations, but it also influences our behavior. So on Thursday, we're going to talk more about Chapter 2, Aversive Racism, Implicit Bias, and things like that. But make sure you submit a personal memo, reflection memo for today's class. Thank you.